First and foremost, you want to make sure everyone's working towards the same thing. If everyone's not working towards the same impact in the long term, then those goals can shift and they can sort of start to become misaligned. So the notion of aligning around purpose across a whole organization is usually where we start. You know, thinking about purpose as the impact you want to have for the very long term beyond profit.
Welcome to the IDOU Creative Confidence Podcast, a series focused on building your confidence at work to tackle your biggest creative challenges.
Join us as we learn insights and lessons straight from IDEO and today's most impact-oriented design thinking leaders.
Hi, I'm Suzanne Gibbs Howard.
And I'm Kalita Stafford.
Hello, I'm Suzanne Gibbs Howard, and welcome to the Creative Confidence series. We created this series to enable more people around the world to work in more creative and confident ways. And we talk about topics in creativity, leadership, growth, and change. And today I have with me Matt Chow.
Good morning.
Welcome. And I'm super excited to have him here with you today. We're going to talk a lot about how you might prototype an organization. Just to share a little bit about Matt. So Matt came to us at IDEO. He started off working in all sorts of efforts all around the world. So he was working extensively in the Middle East and in Asia. He's Canadian citizen, but he spent a lot of time working on projects such as Masdar City. So working in Dubai and helping to set up the first carbon neutral city ever. And so thinking through not just the design of that city, but also the systems and the organization that needed to support that. So after that, he went back to school for a little while, and then we were very fortunate to have him come and join us at IDEO, where Matt has the good fortune of being one of IDEO's first formal organizational designers. And so I thought we would start off just by having you explain what in the world is organizational design.
Yeah, good question. It sort of speaks to my journey in organizational design, where, as you mentioned, before IDEO, I don't know if I ever called myself an organizational designer, but I worked on these complex projects that were trying to do new things. So technologically advanced things, things that required new business models. And for all the companies that I work for, I kind of realized that actually in different degrees, our successes or failures were determined by how we organized to do something new. And I just kind of realized that there weren't that many people who had figured out how to organize for innovation. And so I think it was interesting that IDEO clearly was nerding out on organizational design around the same time I was. And I think the version that we practice here is very true to what IDEO has always done in terms of understanding the needs of humans deeply, in the case of organizations, whole systems of humans, and then designing the change of how humans interact with, in this case, each other often, iteratively.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting because I feel like so many things that are about innovations have focus on the thing itself or the experience itself, or there's so much focus in a wonderful way on the customer's experience or the end user's experience. Mm-hmm. But we need to focus equally on the experiences of the people delivering that and then scaling it over time. And that's often the breaking point is when you get past that first version and try to figure out how to sustain it over time.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Just to hear you talk a little bit more about the relationship between a big, bold change that you're designing for and like a movement or a big shift in a business strategy. Mm-hmm. How do you think about integrating the organizational part of that? When does it come in and how do you make that happen?
Yeah, I mean, we frame change in three different buckets. The first is around mobilizing. So it's really about getting people inspired and on board with the notion of change. Mm-hmm. There's a whole series of interesting things you can do. The second bucket is really around pioneering. So you need to see manifestations of the change that that show what it could look like for your business, whether that's the new project or the new outcome. I think pioneering is important to build that belief in change as well. And then you need it to scale, and very much the way you would think about developing a product. And sort of, you might not start at full scale. We think a lot about proof of concept. I think the same mentality applies for organizations. And so failing before you scale, and certainly all those notions that we talk about products, we think about the same organizations in the same way.
Yeah, I love that. When you think about failing before you scale, mm-hmm. you were sharing with me the other day, you have this great metaphor that you think of when you talk about what it's like to, you know, we think about journey mapping. Lots of people talk about service design and mapping mm-hmm. the customer journey. But when you're mapping an organization, you have mm-hmm. this metaphor about thinking of it as a game of pinball.
Yeah.
I'd love to have you just share that with our community.
Well, the way organizations have often been designed is you sort of stare at the organization. You try and understand it in all of its complexity, and you try and predict everything that would happen if you change something. Mm-hmm. And I just think of pinball, like when you approach a pinball game and there's complexity, there's different nooks and crannies and bumpers. Some will be more challenging. Some will give you more points. You don't sit and stare at the pinball game and try and understand exactly where to place the pinballs yeah. for very long. You usually just throw a pinball in, see where it bounces around, see where you start generating more points, see where you start losing, you know, more points. And then do that over and over and learn. And organizations are a bit the same way, especially in terms of understanding them. The notion of dropping a pinball through an organization is often like, let's follow a process of how work gets done. Yeah. Let's see how a product gets produced and observe what are the pain points, both in terms of people and processes and structures and tools.
Yeah, yeah. I love this. So we put up an image of one that has come in some work that with the teams that both Matt and I have worked with. And this was a disaster relief organization. And I mean, if you just think about how complicated it is to predict after some sort of environmental disaster happens, how are you going to get the resources and the talent and the knowledge to the people who are in that moment of need when you can never predict exactly what's going to happen where? And so this lovely like pinball metaphor mm-hmm. is just how our team was beginning to figure out, well, what's going to happen there? And let's just play through a scenario and start to figure out what parts of the organization, what capabilities, what behaviors, what skills are needed at what time.
So I actually think the opposite might be true. I think some of these org problems might make for good pinball games.
Totally. So one of the things we wanted to do today, you know, we always like to dive in mm-hmm. to specific stories. And so we gave you a challenge. Mm-hmm. So we said, let's pretend or tell us a story about a time when you were in a particular challenge or mm-hmm. project and you had minimal resources, mm-hmm. literally an hour and a couple of people's brains mm-hmm. to work through and start to think about an organization. What would you do or how yeah. would you tackle this?
It's a bit like if you're going to start dropping pinballs in, you want to drop free or cheap pinballs at first. Yeah. But I think the same mindsets of prototyping, say a product or a service, definitely apply in terms of like identifying what the key assumptions you want to test are. Mm. So we had a project where we're working with a nonprofit client that was thinking about what if they switch? What if they were less dependent on philanthropy and were actually like revenue generating and sort of for profit? And so that was the biggest assumption and everything that goes into being for profit. And so what we did is we set up, you know, a 1 hour role play. And when we thought about the role play, we thought, you know, what is the most extreme version of being for profit that you could use to test this organization? So we thought, what if they're just investors? You know, what if they're venture capitalists? Not suggesting that they should be, but that would really test some of these interesting capabilities and processes and tools that they would need. And so we prepared a pitch book, like a false one. I think we called the company Triangle, which vaguely might sound a little bit like Square. but we made a fake pitch book and we walked into the room. We got a couple key people from the organization. I think it was an organization of 50 people. We got, you know, 5 people that broadly represented a cross section of the organization. And we put this pitch book on the table, handed it to the leader of the organization and said, hey, you want to invest in this company and you want to evaluate it. What would you do? And so that was our pinball. And then we dropped it in and we sort of followed around. And she said, oh, I would hand it off to this person first to evaluate. And then the pinball game started.
Nice. That's wonderful. And I know like some of the things that I like about that are the fact that you're going for an extreme version to like over-accentuate mm-hmm. the organizational shifts that might need to happen just to feel them out and help. Mm-hmm. Because I think sometimes if it's too subtle, mm-hmm. people just fall back into the typical behaviors and things that they would do. Mm-hmm. You've talked to me a little bit about some of the other things that you do in the background to get the most out of a role play. You know, I think mm-hmm. so many times people think about improv, but it's like some of the prompts around it, the physicality, the pitch book, mm-hmm. and then a board behind them
to capture learnings.
Yeah, I think making sure you're capturing the learnings with intentionality. So if the shift is about going from nonprofit to for-profit, you have some hunches around what are the areas that will be important to that, whether it's capabilities, whether it's processes, the way resources flow, the stakeholders you currently have. Oftentimes, a tool for mapping the observations you see is really important. So you're not just taking freehand notes. You're sort of really framing it on the things that matter to an organization. And so, you know, in the example, there's sort of like a board where someone's tracking like, oh, you know, I are listening for and tracking, oh, I heard a capability thing. You know, one of the things we heard was, hey, you know, I can do this job. I have a background in economics. It would require a bit of training. So that's something you can note. We have the capability, but we need to train. And so making sure you're learning with some intention going in is really important.
Yeah. So it sounds like you're listening to where do we have the capabilities? Mm-hmm. Where do we almost have them? And we could maybe grow some in. And where are they completely?
Where do we definitely like, not?
We absolutely. It's something so completely new. And then those are the ones you want to think really hard about strategically. Do we want to go there? Is the rest of the organization behind us or not?
And more than
the hardest moves to
and
make.
Additionally, you can start to design how you go there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whether it's training or it's hiring. Those are acts of like design. You can design those programs.
Yeah. So nice. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I know we also brought another example because we're like, okay, that's easy. Mm-hmm. You can do something in an hour, role play, setting the conditions so that people really feel it, getting tangible. But then you have another great concept that I just love. So we talk a lot about MVPs and innovation, minimum viable products. But you started talking to me about the minimum viable organization. So I'd love for you to share, how do you start to do that? What's an example?
It's interesting because the notion of an MVP and what it represents and what it gives you is sort of everywhere. I was speaking to my friend's child and their 5-year-old and they were talking about MVPs. It might be a Silicon Valley thing, but the notion of starting small so you can fail cheaply and design iteratively is important. And coming back to the pinball, the first pinball, make sure it's free or cheap. But the second pinball, even if it needs to be more expensive, make sure it's just a little bit more expensive. And I think there are so many opportunities where people are designing, you know, early concept products and designing minimum viable products. Each of those is an opportunity to design a minimum viable organization alongside that can scale and grow and learn at the same time. And so one of the projects where we did this was actually with an international airport, a big international airport, and we were looking at their baggage service delivery organization. As you can imagine, an airport, lots of people, lots of complexity. Execution is really important in terms of safety and precision. And so as a result, there are a lot of people working on a lot of problems. And to get, they're optimized for what they do today, not necessarily to do things differently. They had the foresight to hire us and try it.
And so many silos.
So many
always,
silos.
Always, I mean,
yes.
the typical org challenge of the day is that so many silos,
yeah.
So many different people.
Yeah, and I mean, this was sort of an arm's length formerly governmental organization.
Yeah.
So the legacy of that, and I'll pick on it because it's in Canada, and I can because I'm Canadian, but you know, the legacy of that still remained. And so we're looking at different types of things that we could do. The service prototype we're looking at is, what if on monitors at the arrival hall, you could see an expected time for when your baggage would arrive. And we had all these incredible service design research insights. My favorite was, you know, somebody was standing there like really anxious to get their bag right, you know, right where it drops the chute. And then we saw them pick up their bag and then run to the bathroom.
Oh.
And it was just striking. So we went to talk to them and we asked, you know, why didn't you just go to the bathroom first? And they said they were so anxious, like they, you know, didn't feel comfortable. They just wanted that moment of relief when the bag came so that they could know it arrived, that they would, you know, hold off going to the bathroom for up to like 30 minutes. And
oh
so
my goodness, yeah.
This is a big pain point. We designed a service around that. But you can imagine, like, to pull off the intelligence required for that is a big lift and kind of cut across the current baggage organization. And so we said, okay, we're going to pull this off, you know, who do we need to be involved? And the list that came back was no fewer than, I think, 80 to 90 people. Because you can imagine, like, there's regulation. Oh. There's, like, when the plane lands. There's the airlines. There's the different terminals involved. There's the baggage crew. There's customs and immigration. And so from that list of 80, we said, okay, if we're just going to pull off this prototype once, who needs to be involved? And if we're doing the minimum version, so instead of actually having a data system, we just had someone looking at the plane with a stopwatch and saying, hey, the bags are off. Or saying at the next checkpoint, hey, the bags are here, so we could track that.
I love that prompt of if it's not about pulling it off yet for mm-hmm. all time. It's not about scale yet, mm-hmm. but just to do it one time so that we can test and see what are the experiences even.
Yeah. And so we came up with about a dozen people that needed to be involved. Still pretty big as far as minimum viable organizations go. But interestingly, they were very cross-sectional. There was one person from citizenship and immigration. It was one person from the airline. And so from there, you know, they continued to develop this service prototype and obviously needed to bring more people in. But starting from that minimum version allowed them to start from minimal bureaucracy, and then certain changes and certain areas where we needed more resources could be added over time.
Hi, Suzanne here. I just want to tell you a little bit more about IDOU. We're an online school where anyone can learn to solve anything creatively. And if you're curious to go deeper into the topics of this webcast and learn more about IDEO's tools and mindsets for organizational design, join our Designing for Change online course. Now let's get back to the conversation. I wanted to start to pull in some of the questions. What we've done, we had a wonderful number of questions submitted in advance. We've also pulled from some of the past questions that we've gotten in and asked Matt to think about them in advance. There was one that I really liked from a woman named Rochelle Knowles, and she was asking about when you are designing with an organization, relatively speaking, newer capability, or there are newer mm-hmm. words, trending up. Mm-hmm. There's usually kind of one or a very few people who are in charge of that change and mm-hmm. the organizational change. And so one of the things I know you're very thoughtful about is involving larger numbers of people. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you could talk about, like, how do you help those shifts happen, and why is it mm-hmm. valuable to include more people in the earlier stages?
Yeah, it's so funny because there's that tension. We just said design with as few people as possible, the notion of minimum viable organizations. But also you do have to engage and socialize ideas along the way. Otherwise, the abrupt, you know, hey, we have the answer to the whole organization is very sort of jarring version of change. And I think the key there is maybe not the number of people, but it's how they're engaged. So oftentimes, the notion that organizational design is someone else's job suggests that someone is designing the organization for me. Through prototype typing, we often try to flip that to someone's designing the organization with me. And that's a big shift where people are involved in creating the MVO, not just showing up and being part of the MVO. Or people are involved in, like, some of the design of the service as well. I think, you know, there's all that research about how people support what they design.
Yeah.
And that's a real just like universality that we've found, ourselves included. And so doing the things with an MVO in mind, including people in the design, as well as the debriefing, and then increasing the amount of people that are involved over time as you increase this MVO is a nice way to make it feel like it is many people's jobs and more people's jobs over time.
Yeah. So you start with the little mini role play in five mm-hmm. people. You scale up to involving 12 and maybe a few others who have a say, and then over time, slowly let that snowball.
And making it feel light is important. So often you pull interdisciplinary, you know, task forces, and it's like, you know, 20% of your job. And it's just, and it ends up being not your job's 80% and this task force is 20%. It's your job's 100% and this task force is 100 to 120%. But if you pull people into the design of a 1 hour prototyping session, it could be, you know, an hour. And then the one day sort of service prototype could be, you know, like half a day to design. And so mm-hmm. making sure that the commitment starts very low as well as the number of people is important.
You had a really lovely story that you told me once about this, like thinking about involving people in something, and that it can even be metaphorical. If what mm-hmm. you're really studying is the dynamics of an organization and who has influence and informal influence, you called it the blue hat.
Oh yeah.
Tess, I love some of these things that you design that are like little game-like motives.
Yeah, first of all, it's fun. But we were with a law firm and we had redesigned their employee feedback process. Super interesting work and a super interesting firm. And so we had designed what we felt was, you know, really interesting new shifts in how people engage for feedback. But we're thinking about how do we roll this out as a big global organization with many people who had done feedback in a certain way for a long time. And so when it came to sort of activating and rolling out that, we had certainly engaged lots of people through prototyping that new service. But, you know, relative to the scale of the organization, still not much. And so we had, a cross-sectional group of people call in or sit into a room. And the job was around, how do we scale this? But instead of asking for tips on how we scaled this feedback program, we just said, we just wanted to uncover like how things get scaled in the organization. And often, like, especially at this law firm where there isn't like a centralized sort of node of power or formal power, you know, influence was really important. So we said, okay, instead of scaling this feedback program, what if we just tried to make everyone in this company wear a blue hat? It just so happened that my sort of teammate just bought a fancy blue hat that day. And so we said, you know, if we want everyone to wear this blue hat, something completely ridiculous, what would we do? Huh. And there were some laughs. And then people started to come up with things like, you know, I would just pay them to wear a blue hat. And then stories came out about, oh, you know, well, we had other programs about tracking hours and we would fine people for not doing it. And it was incredible. Like, irrationally, people would pay thousands of dollars to not, you know, do, you know, account for the billable hours differently. And so that we were able to test different areas of influence.
So metaphorically looking at something as simple as like, let's get everyone to wear blue hats. But then you think about what are the incentives or detriments, the carrots and sticks that help people scale or not.
And how does influence really happen? And that happens a lot through stories. And another story we heard was, hey, this satellite office, which is actually really small, formally maybe doesn't appear to have a lot of power. When they adopt something, usually they adopt it really quickly and across their whole company. So, you know, for me as a leader of Office Y, when I see Office X adopted, I'm like, oh, that's probably worth doing. And they've learned some things. And so instead of starting with the biggest office, which was actually our hunch, we started with the smallest office. And that became successful.
And so you're looking at how you can kind of create those small actions, start to get them to adopt, and then let those stories kind of catch and scale it across.
Because of your learning where influence actually happens. Mm-hmm.
So, and I'd love to push a little bit more on this. We're starting to talk about, okay, so you've got a successful MBO. Mm-hmm. You want to scale it. You're thinking about things like influence and where to start and where to implement the first example. What are some of the things at the larger organizational level? What do you think about as the levers that you're playing with to cement a new shift, if that's even the language you would use?
Yeah. Coming out of an MBO, you will still have things you don't know about how it will work at scale. And so the notion of scaling an MBO still involves like scaling it iteratively and trying to test and look for those key opportunities for design. But as you get to bigger and bigger scale, those levers become a little bit different. So at a small level, for example, you know, in the 1 hour pitch book, it was actually just like, do we have the talent? You know, like, could we pull this off? When you start to accumulate an MVO of like, hey, we have the right talent represented, it starts to become a little bit more about, you know, how do we work together? What's our like structure and governance? You know, are people incentivized in the right way? You know, do they have the right tools to be able to communicate and collaborate in the right way? Especially, you know, scaling often involves scaling to multiple locations or to sort of different offices where people don't see each other face to face as often.
Yeah. So you're starting to lay down the processes and the structures and the incentives. And I feel like, I think one of the patterns that we've seen over time at IDEO is that most organizational change and culture change processes start from the process, the structures, the incentives, more top down.
At scale.
And this prototyping first model really helps you start from the behavior shifts that you want to see and roll it forward to the actual structures of the organization and the platforms for the culture over time.
Every situation is different, but often the first thing you're trying to understand is, do we have the talent to pull this off? And then the second thing, as you scale, starts to be, you know, how do we support our talent? How does the talent work together in order to pull it off?
Wonderful. So a couple of other questions that we've been asked. There are some things you mentioned working with organizations and teams that are distributed. When you think about organizational change and culture and keeping a sense of common purpose, so what are examples of things where you've actually seen virtual teams hold together around a new or shifted purpose?
Yeah, we're timely. I'm working with a really big complex global organization right now. And I think the first and foremost, you want to make sure everyone's working towards the same thing. Because a lot of what happens when you're sort of distributed remotely is you're working on goals, But if everyone's not working towards the same impact in the long term, then those goals can shift and they can sort of start to become misaligned. So the notion of aligning around purpose across a whole organization is usually where we start. You know, thinking about purpose as the impact you want to have for the very long term beyond profits. And that starts to inform, the purpose starts to then inform what are your sort of like strategic ambitions, what are the goals you're trying to achieve, and those can shift on a slightly shorter time frame, probably more 3 to 5 years, say, but making sure you're aligned on that and going down through the cascade of like, in the long term, are we on the page, same page, trying to accomplish things? In the slightly shorter term, are we trying to accomplish the same goals? And then going down from there and thinking about what are the ways that we want to work together in terms of systemizing the tools that we use to communicate. Communication is so important.
And so you feel like things like that are as important or even more important when you're working with people distributed around the globe where they don't get to bump into each other having coffee or tea.
Definitely, yeah. And I think designing the tools often suggests like, what is the software we use to send email or some email alternative? But I think thinking about your tools for communication can include like really intentionally designing your in-person meetings, like really experientially. You're going to see each other at the once a year annual conference. Let's make sure those are incredibly immersive, that they supplement for some of the casual interactions that you don't always have, and make it a really deeply experiential, purposeful design.
Yeah. And I think so often when people are coming together and it's a rare moment that they get to come together physically, they feel like they need to knock out.
Let's get through the agenda.
The tactics, right? Out, yeah. And actually by making space and time to lay down purpose, values, core principles, or some whatever level of guidelines is common and most important for the leaders of a group or a group that needs to work together virtually, that investment pays back over time.
Yeah. And I think the business doesn't stop while you're doing that.
Yeah.
And thinking about purpose in two phases. One is the articulation of a purpose that feels authentic and aspirational. And that time is actually pretty short. It's sort of, you know, maybe it's a couple months. The second phase of purpose is really around the activation of purpose. And that's almost the ongoing thing, is seeing your articulated purpose in your work.
Yeah.
But having the articulation up front and making sure you're on people around the organization are on board with that allows you to sort of take your time and constantly be designing the activation of your purpose.
Yeah, I think that's so important. And I think some of the questions that we have around how much time does this take, you kind of said it takes 2 months, but it's not 2 months, 15 people locked in a room the entire time.
Everything else stops.
I feel like things like articulating purpose and especially activating purpose, I always think of as it's more like choreography. Mm. You need to keep that flow moving, and somebody or a group of people needs to stay on it to keep it moving over time, because you can come together, you can discuss purpose, start to feel what it is, go off, everybody goes back to their jobs, come back and see what we were talking about before. Does that still make sense? Mm-hmm. But the activation of it, I know there were some questions that were sent in advance where people were saying, you know, somebody was working in schools, they had an effort that had gotten off the ground and was really changing the ways that hundreds of educators were teaching across the school system, and it was starting to wane. And that is so natural. It's just, how do you come back in and plan ahead to have like a reinvigoration moment? Because people get busy, other things come into their radar. So I don't know if there are things that you could share about that you've seen work well in activation of purpose to keep a change moving.
Yeah, I think to the extent that you can avoid, we're designing the change and then we're flipping a switch and we're executing the change, the better. So this notion of iterative change, starting with prototyping, but increasing the scale iteratively over time is really important, even after you're really launching at scale. In terms of activating, I think having a plan where you start, you know, with small activations and you make sort of bigger and bigger activations, so that it doesn't feel like, okay, you've articulated, you need to flip the switch and execute it, is important. And I think saving some of those little things for later on is often a good way to keep the sort of stoke the fire as well, you know.
I've seen so many of our teams do that, where it's so, you get so excited about the launch of a new effort, whether that's a new venture that the company is taking on or just a new feedback process that you've put your back into creating. And so people kind of pony up everything at the launch moment instead of thinking, we need to save some of our really good ideas that are going to attract attention for later phases where we need to recatalyze. Or we've got some excellent examples of good things that have happened because of this. We want to tell those stories and have a creative way to keep people motivated.
It's also interesting to think about activation as, you know, forced into two buckets of either quick wins or bold moves.
Yeah.
And the inclination is do the quick wins first and do the bold moves later because they're harder. But to the extent that you can sort of prioritize quick win and bold move early and then quick win and bold move later and sort of keep a constant flow of quick wins and bold moves, it'll make it a little bit easier to continue to stoke the fire.
Yeah. Like give me an example? Of something's quick win or bold move, just so that we get a sense of the scale and early and late.
Yeah. Quick win, you know, in a recent project, we just said, you know what, on Fridays, we're going to do lunch and share stories about how, you know, it was a purpose project about how, you know, purpose showed up in our work this week. Mm-hmm. And that costs as much as lunch. And it's sort of quick and easy to implement. You don't need to sort of prepare. It's just a conversation. So often the conversations are the quick wins. Mm-hmm. Or we also had like a little behavioral nudge where one company was really focused on listening. And so we put a card, you know, we created these cards that we put on their table that was just a little nudge. All of the leaders were like really, on board with focusing on listening. But in the day-to-day, it was hard to make sure they found the time and make sure they're intentional about it. So we said, we put a card on their desk and a card holder. The card was for them to give out to one employee at a time. It said, hey, email me and schedule a time to visit. And on the card holder, it said, this is your invitation to listen. On the card, it said, this is your invitation to share. And they just sort of made that, I think, roughly a monthly ritual. And so that's like a quick win that aligns with this value of listening.
Hmm, nice.
A bold move might be launch a venture, you know, it might be let's announce to the world or it could be
a whole new process implemented.
A whole new process implemented.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Wonderful. Mm-hmm. And how long, when you think about length of time, I see a question from William about the length of time that it takes to go through iterations. And I know that's so relative, but I'm just curious if you have any guidelines for people about how to think about managing the attention and the sense of pace of an organization if you'd like to try some of these quick wins or bold moves.
I'll preface it with most of the time will be spent either preparing with a lot of intention for, you know, any type of organizational prototyping and debriefing with sort of rigor. And so first, it's important to note that like of the time spent, that's where a lot of it goes. And so if you're starting with, say, a service prototype that could take a couple hours, oftentimes if it's, you know, a 12-person complex, highly regulated environment like the airport, we pull that together in about a week of design with the core design team, with 2 1-hour touch points with the people who would be involved in the MVO.
Mm-hmm. And core design team is?
In that case, it was 2 people.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And then we debriefed with the full team for 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a very complex, still early, but very complex organization.
Yeah. And that core team's thinking and processing and documenting for a long time after, but it's a great way to leverage 2 people at the core, and they're really focused on it, and then lots of other people's perspectives coming into the mix.
A thing we did at the debrief is ask the whole group what they want to do next.
Yeah.
You know, and that starts to inform the design of the next MVO as well. And I think making sure, you know, with those clients, the first few we did, the inclination was always like, oh, we want to launch this. And we had to sort of shepherd them to be like, well, what assumptions do you want to test next and who do we need? And so we redesigned from that. I think the next one was a little bit more like a one-day pilot with, you know, a little bit closer to touch points over the course of a month to prepare because it involved an external vendor to test software.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then what about pushback? What kind of organizational pushback have you gotten? And maybe in the airport or in other examples, what do you do to keep things moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, pushback usually comes in 2 forms. One is, I don't want to do this.
Mm-hmm.
2 is, I don't think we can do this. And oftentimes 2 informs number 1. But I think I think knowing that you're pulling together a minimum viable organization, it kind of just requires very few people to be on board. And so I think there's this a notion that if you're accumulating 5 people to do this work, there's some key people who should be on board, especially at leadership level, and getting leadership buy-in is super important. That's almost its own topic. But making sure you're not trying to force it on someone who just doesn't want to do it. And that could be for a lot of reasons. I don't want to do it because of the time involved, and even pulling an hour is often a lot of time for some people. Or, you know, it's not, I don't believe in it yet. I haven't seen the evidence yet. And so, you know, starting with the people who aren't pushing back and seeing if you can accumulate an MVO with that is a really great mindset. And as you scale, I think telling the story of the evidence through your previous prototypes is really important. Like, that's how you engage sort of stakeholder feedback. And you have fewer and fewer sort of people who will push back.
I think also having, I love what you're talking about. And as you tell those stories, as you move through a series of organizational prototypes and start including more and more people, having mechanisms for them to share their feedback, because I think over my experience, I've seen diverse kinds of naysayers and diverse kinds of resistance. There are the people who are going to be harder to turn. There's really something so deep-seated in it that they just really want to see this effort fail. And then there are the people who are just thoughtful and experienced and maybe a little nervous about it. They realize their life is going to get a little bit harder through this transition, but they want the larger success to happen. So their feedback is so incredibly valuable. And if you just take the time to listen, I think sometimes it's about a shift in words and the ways that we're explaining things, or a gentle shift in the process. Maybe there's some stakeholder that we didn't include yet. And so really taking the time and designing the mechanisms for that debriefing and feedback so that those people are not just feel heard, but are heard and are included in next iterations.
The other thing is probably coming back to the blue hat example, understand where influence exists in your organization, both formally and informally. So we talked about oftentimes formally it exists at the leadership level. And so making sure you have as many or the right leaders on board, but also really paying attention to the informal influence. And oftentimes that's been the case where really pushback has defeating pushback has really taken off is when you sort of flip someone who was the biggest hater at first and they're brought on board. Oftentimes those are people who are very influential as well, informally.
And so, I know there are some things about influence, but do you have any tips for people when we're saying find a quick win, find the right place to start small? How do you figure that out?
Yeah, I think it's good to start with constraints.
Yeah.
So say, what can we do in an hour? What can we do with $50? What can we do with three people? And so, and for every organization, your constraints are different. And a quick win will look different for some, you know, big organizations with time and resources. A quick win might be, you know, actually pretty big. I think the other thing about quick win, having a quick win is not just it being quick, but also it being a win. So thinking about if we learn from this experiment, what proof does it give us? What sort of evidence does it provide for people? And how could we tell that story? And so, so making sure it's sort of a visible thing, making sure you're capturing it in the right ways, making sure you're bringing the right people into it.
Yeah.
So make it quick and also cheap, but also a win.
Yeah. What is something that you're focusing on now in your own personal practice?
Yeah, there's so many. Once you sort of start to pick at it, there's so many amazing opportunities for organizational design. I think, you know, especially thinking about diversity, equity, and inclusion, I think having, you know, a complex organizational problem we're solving today, I think we're I'm really excited, and we've done a bit of work in that to think about how you can make that feel small and simple at the beginning, and then sort of scale that to learn. And this might be an especially IDEO thing, but making it fun. And so if organizational design at IDEO is really about learning deeply and then scaling iteratively, the learning deeply is actually really challenging, because you're not just talking to a person about how they use a product. You're talking to a lot of different people about how they depend on each other. And we found that actually using games is a really great way to learn about people. So role-playing games or, you know, different types of teamwork games, which are always fun for everyone involved, both to design and to execute, but actually help you learn.
Nice. Yeah. So with that, thank you. Time flew especially fast this morning. Yes. I know if any of you out there are wanting to learn more about this, we do have an entire course called Designing for Change that is created by the team and the community that Matt works with here at IDEO. So thanks for joining us. We'll be back again soon with more of our Creative Confidence series.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Creative Confidence from IDEO-U. Stay up to date on our Creative Confidence conversations and send your questions for our upcoming guests. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, and sign up for our IDOU newsletter at idou.com/cc. Thanks for joining us.